Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Craig Hamilton of CitizenCraig.com. Ben Stark of Wonder Mill Films.
Hello, Craig.
Hello.
So, after a hiatus that was not planned, we are returning to Harry Potter so that we can never return to it again. Closing out our series of discussions on the Harry Potter movies, every discussion, which I enjoyed immensely. So I'm happy to get back on the phone with you and go through kind of like a wrap-up and talk about some elements of the franchise that we feel like is special and then rank the movies, which is obviously the most important thing a movie fan can do is to rank things. So are you ready to go?
I am.
So, I mean, the major thing I wanted to talk about that we kind of got into last time, but something we haven't talked a lot about is the scores of the Harry Potter movies.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, I think we all agree that John Williams and his work on the first film does so much to set the tone for not just the scores of the films, but also the films themselves, you know, the mood. And, I mean, I feel like you can hear the notes of Hedwig's theme and instantly be transported to a time and a place. And I think that's really special. And then, of course, he scored, is it correct, he scored the first three films before?
Yes.
Okay. And then Mike...
Newell.
Yeah, Mike Newell brought in Patrick Doyle for Goblet of Fire. And Patrick Doyle is a composer who works a lot with Kenneth Branagh and made an amazing, did amazing work on Branagh's 1996 Hamlet movie, which is a wonderful score. But he doesn't, that's probably the one, and similarly to the movie itself, the one that doesn't kind of stand out a ton.
I agree.
Would you agree? Yeah.
Yeah, I would. From the beginning, I think I might have even had the soundtrack, you know, where you bought those little, like, really thin squares that have a even thinner circle inside that you put inside, like, something that accepts it and then plays music out of speakers that's connected to it. They were called compact discs, a.k.a. CDs.
Great.
And I had that, yeah. Well, to get to the point, I always felt it to be, this isn't negative anyway, it's just the style that I remember playing from my days in band, as a young band. It's no surprise that I ended up liking Harry Potter, is it? Anyways, it felt really American, and maybe I'm incorrect in
that
assumption.
Wait, the Patrick Doyle?
Yeah, the style felt very kind of, and it was, you know, we've talked about it being kind of like a schoolhouse, you know, tone. I think the music even does, they have their own theme, they have their own version of Yay Alabama, you know, as it were. and it's just very brassy, which I love brass, but it's very marchy and brassy and pumpy.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Collegiate, very collegiate.
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, and it's beautiful. I think about some of the, there's one theme that in particular that it still plays in my head every now and then, and sometimes I'll hear it in other pieces. Hopefully they're not Patrick Doyle pieces. But there's parts of it that I absolutely love. It's beautiful, but it's my least favorite for sure because it feels disconnected.
Yeah, it just kind of doesn't stand out in a way. And then I'm not clear exactly who scored Order of the Phoenix. Was it Nicholas Hooper?
That sounds right.
Yeah, because he did, if he did, he did that and Half-Blood Prince, which the Half-Blood Prince score, I think, is a really underrated little piece of work. And it has this really cool flourish at the beginning, you know, that plays over the Dementors, or not the Dementors, the Death Eaters flying through London. And it builds really cool. So there's, he did some cool stuff. And then, of course, Alexander Desplat, rounded out the series with those last two movies, which are so dark and moody. And there's, it's really hard to pull out any particular themes or kind of big moments, but it all works so well together as one big piece.
You can start to pull out the themes because I believe he introduces Lily's theme. I don't think that existed before. And the very beginning, track one of part two, so I guess it could be confusing because technically it's in the middle. But that from then on, that theme sort of pokes its head up every now and then. And it's really beautiful. I Deadly Hallows part two really hit me hard. I thought that was some really great work. I think the Splot's one of the best guys working right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's definitely in that top five probably. Cool. So, I mean, which of those scores do you think is your favorite?
Well, I wish I'm not going to get too deep into this, but I have listened to all of them and ranked them in really stupid, unnecessary detail and how I listen to it. Formulas may be involved, and it may be
amazing.
I don't know. I'm telling you, it's ridiculous. It's
amazing.
Just kind of, but I'm not sure what those rankings are. Then I try to update that stuff every now and then. I think I did it about a year ago, so it's time for a re-listen. But you said start with my favorite, or at least
yeah, just kind of the standout for you.
Okay, it's really hard to not go with the first one because that's where Hedwig's theme began. John Williams created this sort of really unmistakable, quirky yet a little moody theme that exists throughout. But I really think Deathly Hallows Part 2, I could go back and listen to that one over and over. To me, it's amazing.
How about
yourself?
I'm the same. It's. I hate to be cliche. I hate to pick the easy one, but yeah, it's the first one. It's just so iconic. It's John Williams. It's the same. I feel the same way that I feel when, you know, people ask like who the best composer is of all time. It's like, well, it's John Williams. Like I'm sorry, we can't have that conversation unless we take him off the table, you know.
Right.
So
he's in the what do they call it? What is Film Spotting has a
Pantheon. Yes, he's in
the Pantheon. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that score in general goes in the Pantheon of great scores too, of just, you know, movie music. Music. Yeah. Are there any other elements of the franchise that you kind of want to talk about or highlight? The score was kind of the big thing for me.
Maybe we can touch on the production design. I think.
You can speak to that personally.
That's some amazing stuff. I was when they first took some of the pieces of the set and the art on tour in the States, they hit up Chicago first, and then we actually took a trip up there to go see that. No pictures allowed. No touching of anything. But it was amazing. And they took that stuff on tour, but what they have in London when we were there that we got to see is two big, you know, studio warehouses full of everything that they use, just all of their stuff. And you had free rein to go just do whatever you want. I mean, you couldn't hop over the fence and go into the Weasley kitchen, but you could stand right there and hang over it and look, and they had like the iron ironing the shirt by itself, and like a knife cutting carrots magically by
cool.
itself.
Yeah,
it was freaking awesome. And they had every little a piece of paper from the Weasley's Wizard Wheezes from their joke shop. Like it might have been like a brochure for their shop that you might have seen half a second of in like the top right hand corner. But somebody had gone in and drawn a whole brochure of thing. I mean, the detail was insane, and you never really got to see a lot of that greater detail. But Stuart Craig, I think, right? Wasn't he the one to I think he was there for the duration, so he definitely kind of nailed down a particular style and that stayed kind of throughout, in my opinion, and I think he's still doing some great work now.
Yeah, you're right. I mean that's kind of one of the big the big accomplishments of this whole series, I think, is production design and the way that it maintains that classical movie I don't know. It just feels like because of the production design, it still feels like an old-fashioned big-budget movie, you know, where they make these sets from scratch and they get the actors to interact with them in real life as much as they can. I mean, obviously, a lot of the action scenes and stuff, especially in the latter films, are probably primarily digitally, with digital backgrounds and digital sets. But just when, you know, when they're in these different spaces and Gringotts and, you know, and all the houses and stuff that they go in and out of, and the ministry and all these places, it's so evocative. It's so of this one universe. You know, you think of something like the Marvel universe where it's all connected, but really so much of that is contemporary that it doesn't really stand out as unified from
right.
the production design.
Right.
Obviously Star Wars does, but it's so otherworldly and it's so,
right.
it's so specifically from that first movie that you're really kind of sticking with that. Whereas here you're kind of making it up as you go, but yet there's this continuity to it. And it's
right.
really great.
Exactly. Yeah. And this really could, if we wanted to go into a whole different conversation on art direction, that I think would be a great podcast because you make a great point about contemporary and also whatever the fantasy, would you categorize Harry Potter as fantasy where you create something, but maintain
right.
a consistent throughout, you know, 8 movies and 9
right.
with Fantastic Beasts.
Right. Well, we're not going to talk about that other thing you just mentioned, but you just brought up a good point. So getting to our rankings, is Fantastic Beasts included in yours? I've got
no.
it. Okay.
Oh, well, I could, but it's not right now.
Yeah, let's shove it in there
okay.
if you want, because we haven't
okay.
really talked about it at all, so that'll be a good spot to talk about it whenever we get to it.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Are you ready to start your ranking?
Sure.
All right.
Sure.
We're starting at the bottom here. Who's going first?
I can go.
Well, how's this? Because you're the expert here, I want to hear yours last. So
okay.
by my count, if I go now, when we get to number one, your number one will be last. Is that correct? You're the mathematician here.
But what would my last one be?
Your last one would be your fourth one, right?
Okay. Would I be the last? I get the last word. It's like the Monty Hall problem.
Yeah, it's just like that. So we determined that I will start. And my number 9 of these films is going to be a painful pick, I think, probably. It's Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, which is obviously the first movie.
are you joking? Are
no,
you kidding?
It's
my
favorite of the movies. That said, it's not a bad movie. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful little kids movie with so many wonderful little flourishes, but it's directed like a sitcom. It doesn't move. It doesn't there's no stop proclaiming and making exclamations. There's no visual flair to it beyond the production design and the costume design. It's just the CGI is questionable. It's such a the performances are flat. It's just a rough go. Especially considering it was 2001. It was the same year that Fellowship of the Ring came out, and Fellowship of the Ring is so propulsive and so organic and so engaging on so many different levels that I can't help but compare the two. And when I do that, it's like, so I hate to do it, but the first one is my least favorite of the Harry Potter movies.
And I don't understand it. I don't really want to fight.
There's no fighting. I mean, it's just, we disagree here. And look, you're coming from, I haven't read the books, so you're coming from a very different place than me, and I'm coming from a place purely of movies, you know. So if it doesn't work for me consistently as a movie, then it loses points. And for me, you know, it's like watching a BBC production from 1992. That's kind of what it feels like. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and
it is what it is.
Mentioning the books, the first book is, I watched the first movie and started with the second book, and
right.
I got to the first book, and I was kind of like, I'm kind of glad I didn't start with this. So
okay. Well, I mean, look, there's no question to me that it seems like the first one is the most faithful to the book. And I think that's what you confirmed. Is that correct? The first movie is the
most
faithful?
Yes, yes. Yeah. And I think they had less pages.
Sure, yeah, they could. So, they could do it.
Yeah.
All right, what's your number 9?
It's going to be Goblet of Fire, the fourth installment. To me, it's the director. I read, and we talked about this in the podcast, but Newell was. I read an interview with Newell where he's you know, saying he's making an obvious effort to change kind of the tone and the feel of what it's like inside Hogwarts, and you don't really need to do that when you've got so much story to adapt. Also, and you don't need to do that when you've had 3 films that were. That had continuity in that regard, and you've got 3/4 films to continue that continuity, which is redundant.
Yeah.
And you change it in the middle. It fit that. I completely disagree with that. So.
Yeah, it's my number 8, and it's the same. It's for very similar reasons. It's like, look, Alfonso Cuarón, you know, kind of tweaked the approach a little bit. And it didn't hurt because he's Alfonso Cuarón. And Mike Newell has made some really great movies, but he's not Alfonso Cuarón. So,
no.
Like, well, why don't you focus on the job and keep us going in this universe rather than kind of overcooking it. It struggles for me too from that production standpoint. A lot of the CGI, just a lot of the color grading, it just feels like it's all kind of glossed over with this weird green hue thing that it feels like it's a stylistic cheat to cover up effects, which is a really cynical thing to say, but it's something about it just doesn't strike me. I think it's where the kids are also in a weird transition point where I feel like the first, maybe not the first one, but definitely 2 and 3 have really great, fun, energetic child performances where they're not finicky and not overthinking it, but I think that the fourth one is kind of where they are becoming adolescents and becoming more aware of what they're doing with their faces and their bodies, and I feel like it's just a rough transition, and they lost a lot of that childlike confidence. Yeah. What?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
What?
No.
Yeah, they lost the exuberance of childhood where we're just confident in everything we do, and they haven't yet gotten to the confidence of adulthood where it's like, well, I tricked everybody into thinking that I know what I'm doing, so I don't have to worry about
right.
it anymore. So I feel like that's there. So it's just a rough spot. I remember when it was announced that he was directing, I was like, why didn't Cuarón come back? It was one of those things where they were definitely in transition. They didn't know what to do with the series, and they had a massive book to work on. And they didn't drop the ball again. It's not a horrible movie. It's just, I agree with you, it's one of the weaker ones.
Yep. That was your 8. Oh, let me see. What's my 8?
What's your 8?
This is tough because now I like all of them, even Goblet
right.
of Fire. As I sit back in the day, I could just watch Goblet of Fire, but over and over. I'll probably go with, I'm probably going to go with Chamber of Secrets. To me, it's super long, and some of your critique of the first of Philosopher's Stone, I actually would say for Chamber of Secrets. To me, it feels long. It feels like, you know, like you said, it doesn't move. Maybe it moves more than the first one because I just love the first one, but it feels just like so. It's super long. That's my only criticism. No, I just feel it's. There's a lot of times when it feels like nothing's really happening, and I feel like maybe they could do more to bring in some of the book instead of, you know.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I, to me, it feels, it's just kind of a chore to get through. It just goes on and on. And it's not that long of a book. It's really not. Not that much longer than the first one.
We'll get to that. My number seven right now is one that may go up this list of, on future viewings, but right now it's my number seven. It's Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, which is a really wonderful movie, but I do think it and again, like as its sequels come out and as I watch it again, I do feel like it has a little bit of like, well, we're just trying to recapture the magic here feeling, you know? And
yeah.
I'll be the first to admit that the Eddie Redmayne tics and his affectations kind of bug me. But I understand that it kind of works for that character really well. And I appreciate a lot of the social commentary and the subtext in the movie as well. But for right now, it didn't quite, you know, reach the top of the franchise for me.
Huh. You know what? For a second, I kind of forgot we were including that one. So that I'm going to lump that one into my next one because they're all kind of right here. So I'll do my, what is this? It's my number seven?
Seven, yeah.
Yeah. I love that movie. It's one of my favorites of 2016. But yeah, I think, now J.K. Rowling wrote it herself. There is, I guarantee you, so much more to this story that is going to connect with the past. And that is also going to be completely new. That's going to build on itself, but it's also going to fit right into the world we already know, and it's going to enlighten us on what we already know, and then we're all going to love it even more for that reason, because that's like really, talk about continuity and consistency. If she's able to pull that off, and I think she will, that's going to be just super amazing to write to do this with a prequel that doesn't really, to me, it doesn't feel like a prequel. But anyways, I'm going to put that one in there. You know, I love it. The score's great. Our direction, again, Stuart Craig. Eddie Redmayne. Man, wow, he's getting so much work, isn't he?
He's getting
a lot of work.
Good.
He is.
That's
he's
great.
Working a lot.
Yeah.
He's working a lot, yeah.
Yeah, he's doing a lot of work. it is a work.
Yes.
mm-hmm. His career is a work. What you mentioned about Rowling is one of the great things about the movie. It totally feels like the work of one screenwriter. You know, I think that's what sets it apart from a lot of the other blockbusters that we get a lot of times, where it's like 19 screenwriters. It's more of like a TV writing room. But this is clearly the work of one mind on the page, and then David Yates steps in, and they have such a close working relationship that he's able to, you know, execute it, and it's just like seamless with the other films, and like you said, it builds upon the other films, and yeah, it doesn't feel like a prequel, but it's still at the back of my head. I think I probably subconsciously knock off points just because I know it is a prequel, and that's unfortunate for me. So that was my number seven. My number six is Chamber of Secrets, which is a movie that gets better every time I watch it. And I agree, it is very long, but it's one of those movies that, it feels like, in a way, an old classic Hollywood movie that's like an epic that's very long, where it's like, man, like in the middle of it, I'm like, oh, I'm not sure if I'm really on board with this. But then I get to the end, and Chamber of Secrets has that kind of long camera shot that pulls out from the hall to the exterior of the castle, and I'm like, I feel like I've been on a journey. Like, I feel like I've been on an adventure with these characters, and it's really satisfying. And again, it feels like, I mentioned this when we discussed it, but it feels like a different director came on board, and he just totally, he's moving the camera in ways that he wasn't the first time. Obviously, budget has a lot to do with that. But yeah, it's just a way more exciting movie than the first one, and I like it. I like it more and more every time I see it.
It doesn't feel like a BBC production from the...
It sure doesn't. It feels like a movie from 2002, which is not a bad thing. And, you know, I'm not trying to say that a BBC production from 1992 is bad, categorically. I'm just saying that in this franchise, the first one feels dated, whereas the rest of these don't feel as dated. They feel like a good moment in that time of movie history.
So it didn't feel like a Jeremy Irons and Brideshead Revisited, or
No, it didn't feel like the Chronicles of Narnia.
Because that I like. Wow, that's a quite a criticism to assign such a really bland feel. Because I mean I know exactly what you mean. Those are some great miniseries they made back in the day. But it's almost like watching, you know, natural light and the sun's blaring every scene. You know.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And then that wonderful, like, you know, 60 frames per second video machine. So what's your number six?
Let's see. My number six would be Order of the Phoenix.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's great.
That's my number five, so this is a good time to talk about it.
Well, what am I missing then? Oh, I think I know what I'm missing.
No, you're not missing anything.
You're missing something. Anyways, I'm just kidding. You're missing something in your head for having Philosopher's Stone at number nine.
Yeah, I'm missing the experience of reading the books. That's what I'm missing.
You're really not. Anyways, I love Order of the Phoenix. It's great. I like the score. I don't love the score. Imelda Staunton is great. She captures that horrible person's essence. That's not the plot. That's the actress that plays Umbridge, and she does a great job, is what I mean. I think that's such a hard book to adapt. It's so huge. It's so great. It's teenage angst. They figure out, Harry figures out he's supposed to be mad, but he's not sure why. And it's dark, it's gloomy, and it's got an overall really just blue feel, if I'm going to assign a color to it. And the movie does, too. It's really great. Hagrid's brother, Grop, shouldn't have been in there. Mm-hmm. Some things I would have done differently. The Ministry of Magic's fun. Art direction is insane. I have too many little gripes for Order of the Phoenix, but overall, I love it.
Yeah, I agree on all counts. It does feel like a transition piece, kind of like the fourth one, but it feels like a well-done one, you know, where there's a lot of growth and there's a lot of moments, and it feels like it's just David Yates has such a sure hand with the material. So, yeah, that, like I said, that's my number five. So what's your number five?
My number five would then be... Oh, man.
Yeah, so real quick, as we get into these last few, this is where I started to really shock myself with my rankings, my updated rankings, and what kind of sorted out at the top. So I don't know, you may be going through the same thing, but my number one in particular is I'm surprised at myself. But go ahead.
Yeah, this is really tough because I'm trying to remember. We got four left, right?
You're on your five. You're on your five, so.
Yes, so nine. Okay. I'm probably going to have to go Half-Blood Prince.
Okay.
Which sucks, because I really love that one. But, yeah, I have to go Half-Blood Prince. I'm not sure if I should talk bad about it, kind of, to justify it, but.
I guess talk about because that's a lot of people's, that's at the top for a lot of people. So what, is it the book translation? Is it the movie?
I just like the other ones a little better. I'm talking like the scale right at this point from here on up is like minor variance. I mean, just like microscopic differences in the scale here. So,
real quick, so what is your rating for these? Is the whole series a 4 out of 4 for you? Or
the whole series is definitely a 4 out of 4. I probably would give – I thought Fantastic Beasts was a 4 out of 4. At least a strong 3.5. But Half-Blood Prince is 4 out of 4. They're all 4 out of 4. It's just what kind of like a nostalgia and emotional attachment for me, or how it hit me the first time I watched it from here on out. Half-Blood Prince, I think I really clicked with it the second time I watched it. It's a difficult one to adapt. I thought he did a good job, but there are some things that I'm kind of like, the way the Death Eaters come in, it's like, well, they didn't really need to be there except for moral support. I think they had an actual purpose in the book, so it was kind of like you could have easily bridged that gap there in the movie. But anyways, yeah, I love it. There's some really great moments. Some of the best moments of the series are in there. The art direction with Yates, the art direction kind of took it definitely took a turn for a certain direction, no pun intended, and it stayed there. And Half-Blood Prince is really kind of, it's really all coming together.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's definitely where he kind of came into his own. And you were like, okay, this is the guy for the rest of the, you know,
right,
he's
yeah.
in it for until
yeah.
the end. And well, apparently beyond.
And he knew what he was doing, and he appreciated the material, and yeah, I was totally fine with that.
Yeah. So that was your number five. So my number four is Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. And basically from here on out, it's for me, it's all 4.5 out of 5 or so. I don't know if any of these movies is a 5 out of 5 for me, really. I don't have that personal attachment to them. But, I mean, it's like, it's so close that it may as well be, you know. But, yeah, so Deathly Hallows 2 is... so satisfying in so many ways. It's such a great ride at times, literally. And it's just the way it moves, the way it exposition is handled, and it never stops. And it's a long movie, but it doesn't feel like it. It's just climax after climax after climax, and then it ends on such a nice, quiet note. It doesn't overstay its welcome. I know a lot of people complain that about that with Return of the King, which I don't necessarily have that problem with that film, but I definitely think that Deathly Hallows Part 2 wraps everything up in such a neat package that, in a strange way, it's over before you realize it, and you kind of are like, wait, that's it? Like, that's all we're going to get? I mean, I'm satisfied, but at the same time, you don't realize how much more time you're willing to spend in this universe with these people.
Yeah, hey, good point.
Yeah.
That was your number four, you said.
Right, I think so.
Okay, so now the next one, now we have my number four, so that means there are three left after this one. It's quick
yes.
math. My number four would be, this is so tough.
Yeah.
So tough. Probably Deathly Hallows Part 1. And it's tough. And I'm telling you, these are almost a tie. The last four are almost a tie for me. The Deathly Hallows Part 1 does a really great job of, first of all, adapting that first half of the book. I mean, it's really great. You get some really gorgeous external shots. That the book sort of breezes by as sort of like a time gone, like the amount of the time that has gone by to get the reader to know how much time they've been doing this. And Yates uses that opportunity to really show off some gorgeous landscape and to show, you know, how many different places they've gone and stuff like that. But it's sort of like, they're on this journey in hiding, and it's just they're on the go. They're never in the same place. But it seems to continue to capture that sort of that art directional theme that I think we've seen throughout in the earlier films. So Deathly Hallows Part 1 is just my number four, but it's so close to being my number one.
Yeah, I'm with you. These last few are very hard to pick. And like I said, I'm shocked that they shook out the way that they did. But if I'm honest with myself, this is where I'm at right now. So my number three is Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, which for a long time was kind of my favorite. And it still has so many wonderful qualities about it. It's probably the my favorite one that is whimsical in a way. You know, it's before things get too dark. It's still a lot
right.
of fun, and the way Caron shoots everything, so much movement, so much looseness to it. It's such a fun movie, and but then it also goes in all these different interesting directions, and there's a lot of real tension in there too. And it's another one that just every time I watch it, there's new little things I find out about it and learn about it, and it just grows with time.
Yep, Very interesting. I feel the same way. That's my number three. The constant movement, which is what I one of the it may be the thing I love most about Quran movies, is the just constant movement. It's almost that there's still an innocence there. As when you read this book, at least, the scope of the world of this that Harry Potter exists in, it begins to widen ever so slightly. Actually, it probably doubles in its width, and then with the Goblet of Fire, it completely just expands into this huge thing. You get just a little, you get to peek through the window of what was, and Rowling doesn't let you know too much yet. So there's still this innocence there. There's no Voldemort's not involved directly, things like that. But it exists to expand on its own backstory through Harry's father. There's some confusions caused by the decisions made to in how they decided to what to adapt from the book that sort of bugged me. But those, you know, those exist in some of the other movies as well, where they mess up even more, or they make worse decisions than Quran ever made. But I think the art direction, I think you mentioned this earlier, Quran, it's slightly different in art direction, but still whimsical and dark enough that it maintains that continuity. These kids are still kids. That they didn't try to change how the kids behave, like, you know, Mike Newell did. It's that 1, 2, and 3 to me. 3 is a departure, but they go hand in hand. 2 to 3 is not that big of a gap, and I think that also helps a lot too.
Yeah, absolutely. I like the growth there from the third. And there's no false angstiness in the third one. It's just the right tone. Yep. My number two is Harry Potter and the Half Blood Prince. Which is, you know, the most kind of cohesive one in terms of, like, I feel like it has everything that it should have other than, like, them being little kids. But I just feel like it's got, you know, it's got some of the best Voldemort stuff. It's got the best Malfoy and Harry dynamic. It's got a lot of the best kind of bonding moments. It's got a lot of the best teen drama moments. It feels like maybe the most complete of all the movies, and it's for a long time it was my favorite. It's way up there for me. And like I said, it's hard not to just kind of interchange these three at the top. But Half Blood Prince is my number two.
Cool. Yeah, that's a great one. My number two is Deathly Hallows Part Two, and I think my top two have a lot to do with just my love of this franchise, of this book series, and kind of how it's been just a big part of my life for so long, and how it's, you know, the ending, this, you know, watching the first movie was the beginning of my experience with Harry Potter, and then watching Deathly Hallows Part Two in the theater marked the end of the whole thing, because the books had already been done at that point. And so I think they did a really decent job of adapting this book, and it really helps when you can split it into two different movies. I think the effects are, like, really great. I thought they added the drama and tension in the exact right moments. There's a couple little spots here and there that I'm like, well, I probably should have done it this way, kind of it just changes something that doesn't need to be changed, and but that's okay. It was done so well, and it was just a nonstop, just thrill ride from beginning to end, in my opinion. And there's still so much left to do that they crammed in, that it doesn't feel like they crammed it in. It felt natural. So Deathly Hallows Part Two, my number two.
Yeah, I mean, going back to it, it's just so, there's so much stuff that happens, but it doesn't feel like it's overstuffed, which is, really, really masterful storytelling. But I think one of the reasons it works so well is because of my number one, which I am pleased to say is Deathly Hallows Part One, which is I feel like it's a weird pick, and I'm surprised that I like it so much, because in some ways it's the least Harry Potter of all the Harry Potter movies. You know, I don't think there's any Hogwarts whatsoever. I don't think they ever go to Hogwarts. There's no Dumbledore. There's no Dumbledore. There's no real teachers at all, and it's not at the school. It's just these three characters lost in the wilderness and lost in their own malaise, in a way. And I feel like that alone makes it such an interesting movie. It's the one I connect to emotionally the most. It's the one that sticks with me visually and emotionally the most. I feel like it's got the best performances, and it's just it's hard to call it a complete movie, but I do think that last shot of Voldemort getting the Elder Wand is one of the most just purely badass endings to a movie, at least one of these kind of movies that I can think of. So there's just so much to love here. There's so much going on, and I think one of the reasons that the second one works so well is because this one does everything it needs to set up where the characters need to be emotionally, and it takes them to their darkest places and brings them back to the top just in time for them to help, you know, for them to be unified enough to deal with, you know, one of the darker things they'll deal with, which is the death of Dobby and an innocent friend like that. And so it's an emotional roller coaster, but it's not devoid of action either. There's a lot of really thrilling action scenes and funny set pieces and things like that. But it's so immediate. It's so angry in a way, and it's so bittersweet in a lot of ways. I feel like it's what this kind of a franchise can do. You know, they made a multi-million dollar, you know, almost billion dollar movie that's just about three teenagers fighting in the woods. And I feel like that's the kind of great, movie stuff that a big budget franchise can work in when they're painting on this kind of canvas. And I feel like, you know, you couldn't make seven movies that are just like this movie, but if you're going to make seven movies, why not go out on a limb and make one that's this subversive in a way?
Yeah, I'm really glad it is an odd pick, but I'm really glad you picked it, because it is one of my favorites, and it is one of the best. And I think one of the things that causes us to like this one more is perhaps in that it is different than every other one for the reasons that you stated. I think it just flashes to Hogwarts. They don't go there. You just see it. You see Snape and you see Hogwarts for like a second, just almost to remind you that they're not there. And one of the things reading this book, when I first got it and was reading it overnight, is one of the things that makes it so dark is that they are not at this school that can protect them, that they feel safe, and that we love to read about. They don't go back until the very end. And this movie doesn't have any of those moments. They're constantly on the run. It's dark. It's not happy, although it has its happy moments. It is a dark and trying time for them, and they are able to persevere and accomplish what they need to. And but I thought you described it really well. The arc of that whole narrative for this one is really great, and I agree. It's my number four, but it's so close to number one. I've watched it a couple of times in the theater when it came out, and when anyone ever said that it was kind of a weird, or they didn't really like it that much, I just couldn't believe my ears. I thought it was just amazing.
Yeah, I've definitely gotten into a lot of arguments with people about this one. So
my number one,
right,
is obviously your number nine. And I'll make no qualms about it. The first two, as I said, have a lot to do with just my love for the franchise and the series in and of itself. My first peek into this series was in the books, was to watch this movie, and I immediately went and started, you know, I read the second book after I'd seen the movie, and that that started the whole thing off for me. I thought when I, the second, after the first scene, when I watched this, you know, 16 years ago, I was just so excited that a world like this existed, not in reality, but of course, and there was somebody had written about a world like this, and just was so fascinating to me. It was so unlike anything I've ever seen. And so likewise, that movie now represents so much for me. And I see past its flaws and it's where it comes up short. And for to me, any viewing experience of with this one is always great. So yeah, that's why it's my number one.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly can't fault you for it. It is, you know, as I said, Half-Blood Prince was the most complete, but this one is the most Harry Potter. You know, it's got the score, it's got all the introductory moments, it's got the first glimpses at all of these major characters. So, yeah, I could see myself, you know, ranking it a lot higher had I experienced it the way that you had. And, you know, this stuff is subjective. There's no right answer. And I think that a lot of people would probably agree with you that it's certainly in a way the most loving one, you know what I'm saying? And there's something to say about that. You know, I remember reading Ebert's review. When these first came out, I was so skeptical. I was like, these kids' movies are sure getting a lot of buzz for some reason. And I read Ebert's review and I was like, wow, this makes it sound like such a sweet, you know, necessary movie. And when I watched it, I was like, yeah, absolutely. It's a force for good in the universe. And I think it's a great number one pick. It's also a great number nine pick, but it's you know, for you, it's a better number one pick.
Oh, indeed.
All right. Well,
we bookended that very nicely. I found my Harry Potter score ranking that I did. That was last January 2016. The number one, and I'm going one down. I don't have Fantastic Beasts ranked. Number one is Deathly Hallows Part Two. Number two is a tie between Chamber of Secrets and Deathly Hallows Part One. Number three is Philosopher's Stone. And look at that. Number four is Goblet of Fire, even after all the horrible things I've said about it. But it is good music. You know, I didn't say horrible. I mean, there's some – I still think of some of those themes. They're gorgeous. But number six is Half-Blood Prince. Number seven, Prisoner of Azkaban. And number eight, Order of the Phoenix. It's a little too light for me. For the theme of the film.
Yeah, honestly, I have a hard time remembering any of them except for the first one and Half-Blood Prince and the last two. But I certainly haven't. I don't know anything about music, and you do. And I also haven't spent the time kind of listening to them the way that you have. So, but interesting. I'll have to dive in more to kind of, you know, form my opinion on that. But, yeah. Well, awesome. Well, we have ranked a lot of stuff, and we have talked a lot about Harry Potter. So thank you, Craig, for sharing with me. I've learned a lot from talking to you about this. And I'm looking forward to these movies continually growing in my heart, because they keep giving back every time you watch them again.
And your heart is so dark that it needs all the light it can get.
It does. Every time I watch one of these movies, the little evil demon fetus that's in me shrivels a little bit more, which is good.
Well, thank you for including me.
Of course.
For more Film Nerds Unlimited, go to filmnerds.com or find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you hear, rate and review our podcast on iTunes. Keep an eye out for the next issue of Film Nerds Unlimited, coming soon.